part about husbands and wives.
Yeah.
And it says that, you know, you're supposed to give cover to your father, to your mother, all these people. And even if they scream at you and embarrass you in public, you're supposed to just benacha, sit back, and take it. So somebody asks a question, what about a wife? So Grunstein says the wife is basically the same body as you. So if your wife screams at you and you scream back, you're essentially screaming at yourself. Like imagine you start being mad at yourself, and then you scream back in your own brain. You're crazy. The Sefer doesn't need to explain not to do that to your wife, because it's just absolutely crazy.
Love it. Okay, thanks so much for hosting us. Thank the law firm for, of course, helping this group. I'm part of a group of 8 guys with a rabbi, actually 2 big rabbis who are involved with the group, and we study the complexities of Torah law as it pertains to money. We do this for about 2 hours a day, 5 days a week. When the kids allow me to leave the house on Sunday, it's 5 days, otherwise it's 4 days. But a huge appreciation for the opportunity to study this, because this is really an incredibly important part of the Torah, something that is very difficult to study. And I'm speaking to a room of attorneys, so I have students who are in their first year of law school and they're already like sinking at AWOL completely for a whole year. So I know what it's like, and it's incredible to have this opportunity. One thing that maybe you will not know, I came across the teaching of Rav Kook. Rav Avram Kook was the first chief rabbi of Israel before Israel was even a state. And he writes the most amazing thing, very surprising. It's a person wants to access teshuvah. Teshuvah, in his worldview, is coming back to a state of being alive. So if a person wants to access life at its deepest, what would you do? So you'll think the answer from a rabbi is a deep philosophical, a deep theological, you know. He says, no, you got to study the laws of money from the Torah, from the Shulchan Aruch. You have to know the laws, how the Torah wants us to treat other people's money, how it wants to go about conflict resolution, particularly the conflict that revolves around money. And that is the deepest level of teshuvah that a person can achieve, when they could learn that deeply, as deep as they can, with all of its specifics. So it's incredible. All right, got to think about why that is. It's not obvious that that should be the case. But it's fascinating. Okay, so today the topic that I've come to speak about is a topic that really needs a lot of, it could take hours and hours and hours to even touch on the specifics. And the title was Hiring and Firing because it rhymed, not because we could actually get through all the specifics of hiring and firing, but the laws are pertaining to hiring and firing employees. It's just too complicated to get to everything. So I don't know if we'll talk only about hiring, maybe also about firing, I'm not sure. But one of the most important relationships, one of the most fundamental relationships that people have in their life is work relationships, is who are you working for? Whether it's a person is a serviceman, so they're being hired out by individuals, or whether they're working for a firm, whether they're an employer. So those are basically, those are the most important interactions. Interactions that come under contract, say for Jewish marriage. Jewish marriage is also under contract, right? We see it as a responsibility, as an obligation. So next to our spouses, we have contractual agreements between workers. The subtleties and the nuances provide us with a fascinating framework and an incredibly complex framework. So just try and get to some of the basic issues, begin the conversation so you see what's being spoken about, what's being dealt with. I do assure you that this is the tip of the iceberg, and there is a myriad of issues that are not, of details that are not being discussed, and important details. So just to give you a sense of the complexity, let me start you off with a case and show you how we can tweak subtle differences, subtle details in the case. And that alone will have to provide a different answer. So here's the case, and I'll tweak it. We'll be happy to hear input and to see, you know, what the crowd thinks. I don't know if some of you have gone through these topics before or not. This is my first time learning it through. So like this, let's take a woman named Sue. Why Sue? Because I was reading Fox and Socks last night to my kids. Who sews Sue socks? Sue sews Sue socks, right? Okay. So Sue is hired to do the bookkeeping for someone in her neighborhood who runs a small online apparel company. She has not signed a contract yet, but they have both verbally agreed to come into contract. A day before she signs the contract, she gets a call from her cousin who wants her to do an at-home sales job for a new startup he's creating. The pay is equal, but she feels she owes it to family to work for him. But she's already verbally committed to this other person. Can she back out?
Yes.
She could? Why is she allowed to back out?
No enforceable contract.
There's no enforceable contract?
I mean, how long was she going to stay for?
At will employment.
Well, it's at will, so in theory she could leave a second after she started anyway, so.
She could leave the second after she started? Well, I don't know what. So the truth is, I studied very basic law in Canada. I have no idea what the laws are down here in Florida and how employee relationships work.
I mean, they in your.
Yeah, in this particular case, I'm actually interested to hear how would civil law look at this?
If they didn't agree to a specific time period, and even if they did, it might not be enforceable if it's over a year. But I don't see.
Is there a difference about it being verbal or written? From what I understood, is that there's no difference. A verbal contract is as much binding.
It's more than a year, there could be differences.
But generally
a year.
Speaking,
that's interesting.
Whether it's in writing or whether it's verbal, employment is at will. So you can't bind somebody to say, hey, we have a contract, you can't leave, you can't go work somewhere else, you have to stay working.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Interesting. Wow. Okay, that's fascinating.
Also, in Hebrew we call it the yachasei avodah, the relationship at the work. It was kind of an interaction between them, you know, under the umbrella of working of the job.
Yeah.
What's that mean?
It doesn't have to be written or verbal if they're already
communicating
and
they bring. Oh, cool. So that's interesting. Okay, so that you could already.
Course of action.
Yeah, so that already will have indication of. So this is interesting. Where does the year come from? How does the law come up with a year?
It's called statute of frauds in common law, that certain contracts have to be in writing. Contracts
right.
That will
real estate.
Purchases of real estate.
Guarantees.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so
interesting. Okay.
Is a magic number.
Okay, got it.
I just wanted to clarify something Jose said. I think you're talking about the default is at will, but you could contract something. You could have enter into a written contract for a term of employment.
Yeah.
I don't do. Mm-hmm. You should have had Mike stay here because he's an employment lawyer. But you could have multiple years.
Yeah.
Only if it. Yeah. Okay.
All right. So let's start with this case because this is the most simple case. Because this case we could actually deal with really simply. And then the moment that you step outside the boundaries of this particular instance, then the halakha becomes, just explodes into detail. In this particular instance like this. So as far as the Torah is concerned, there is no such thing as employee at will, employment at will. Am I saying it right? Okay. And what that means is that once I come into contract, I'm obligated to honor that contract. Now, there's something really interesting that we'll talk about, and that is somewhat on a more religious level, if we'll use the terminology, is that a Jewish person is supposed to identify as working for one boss, okay? And you wouldn't think that this is a halachic thing. This sounds like very, you know, esoteric. Wow, it's beautiful, you know, we're servants to God. But in truth, that actually defines the relationships that we have with humans. Meaning, the same way that when you're in a steady relationship, your other relationships take on a different nature. You'll make different jokes if you're married. If you're married, you'll make different jokes with your friends, with women, than if you're not married. So also, if you're in a relationship you're trying to get into a relationship, at least, with the infinite, so your relationships with the finite will take on a different nature. So that actually supplies us with what ends up being employment at will. But we'll see that, because it's not that's not obvious for everybody, for every type of worker.
But in this situation, if the Torah says she has to stay, how long?
Oh, so let's see. So like this, when you come into contract in the Torah law, putting aside that other concept that we're talking about, when you come into contract, you have to honor the contract. There's no like employee rights that you signed a contract, now you could just back out. Shouldn't be such a thing like that. You have to come into a specific exception. So really, once you have the contract, you have to honor the contract. And that's true for the employer and true for the employee as well. Over here, there's a different thing. Over here, they didn't sign a contract. Now, let me just speak out something really, really fundamental in Torah law. And that is that whenever we talk about obligation, in order to create a monetary obligation, you need something called kinyan. Kinyan, in the more Hebrewized accent, so kinyan means a purchase. The pen, there you go. The pen, a very holy pen.
It's mightier than the contract.
So what happens with the kinyan is that you're creating an action. Sometimes the action is symbolic, but most of the time it's not supposed to be symbolic. It's supposed to be something that actually creates a ownership over something, a power over something. Until you have a kinyan, we don't see any monetary obligation, ever. You can't take me to court to get money, to have any monetary reparations or remedies without what we call kinyan. Now, the world of kinyan is very vast, and it's very situational, and it depends what particular type of relationship you're getting into to tell you which type of kinyanim are going to transfer ownership. So that's a whole world, very complicated. But you have to create that. Otherwise, there's nothing binding. So as far as verbal contracts are concerned, in the Torah, they basically don't exist on a monetary level. Now, if you have certain type of witnesses to the verbal contract, okay, we can talk. That might be an exception, but generally, verbal is not. But there's another type of contract other than monetary contract, you know? There's another type of contract. And that's, I don't know, I don't have a good term for it, but what I've coined the term, so this is my own coinage, is an ethical contract. An ethical contract. Why? Because there are many elements in the Torah that tell you that you have to keep your word. And so you're not allowed to back out on your word. So if you've given a verbal agreement to somebody, you have to honor that word. And so over here, in this case, there's a verbal agreement, and so then she would have to honor the word. Now, when it comes to employees, and employer takes on...
Is the verbal agreement enforceable?
It's not financially enforceable.
What does that mean? That's financial.
Meaning I wouldn't be able to take any monetary reparations at all. I couldn't force you to work.
Okay, so it's enforceable by what we call specific performance.
Correct.
Is that
right.
Statement?
There's no specific performance. That's the point.
Well, because under secular law, specific performance is considered to be a more powerful remedy in many cases than monetary.
So what I'm saying is that by verbal, unless I've forgotten what specific performance.
Specific
in the 7 years since I learned it.
You want to fulfill the contract.
Exactly, yeah. So you can't, yeah, so in a verbal contract, you can't do that.
Right, you can't have substituted performance by money.
But you can't force. In other words, you can walk away from the deal. As from a financial point of view, Sue can walk away from this deal.
Well, she's going to have no repercussions.
There's no repercussions.
Just morally.
Yeah, so what does the moral thing entail? So this is interesting. When it comes to employee-employee relationships, as opposed to just be right, as opposed to just having to come before God proverbially, there's actually another dimension to this, and that is that there is something, and here's the Hebrew word, is a very fascinating word called okay, no, this is incredible. Very honored to have David and his father here. Rafael, wow.
Literally a
we couldn't have just one Yehudi Kippah in the room. We have to have at least two, you know. This is wear that purple with pride. Okay. Rav Josh, I don't know why you don't have your purple Kippah yet. Let's go.
We're curious.
I know. If I know there'd be a crowd. Okay, so the Hebrew word for this is called taromet. What does the word taromet mean? It's a very interesting word. I don't think it's used in modern Hebrew at all. But it comes from the word re'imim, which is thunder. Do they still use that in Hebrew? How do you say thunder in Hebrew? Ra'am, yeah. So it's still the modern word. Yeah, in Tehillim it comes up all the time. So ra'am is thunder, which means that if somebody backs out of a verbal agreement, in an employee-employee relationship, you have what's called thunder. What does that mean? It means, what? Here's how I take it to mean. Just going back to the root of the word thunder means to ruin somebody's reputation, which means that because there's an ethical contract here, and because the Jewish people are interested in upholding a society in which people are not backing out on their word and following through on their commitments, if somebody doesn't do that, it's the responsibility of the other party to make sure that other people know that that person didn't do that. So if you're going to be backing out on your word, recognize that society is going to find out about it. And people are going to look at you as a dishonorable individual. Okay, now usually we avoid such a thing. We're not going and shaming people in public. Lashon hara, there's terrible things to shame somebody in public. But in this particular relationship, a person backed out on their word in a employee-employer verbal agreement, then we allow for there to be a...
You have to get a psak though? Like go to Bezin and get a psak that you were right and therefore can go do that? Or you can just...
Yeah, unless you know for sure that you're right. Yeah. It doesn't need to be... Knows. It's not financial. It's not monetary. So it's not going to be like Bezin enforced. But if you want to make sure that you're doing the right thing, you absolutely should be getting guidance. Yeah, absolutely.
It says the most important keter is the keter shemto.
Yes. Very good. That's right. Is a good name. Reputation.
What is the source of this law?
Where is the source of this law? It is a Mishnah in Tractate Bava Metzia, which is the middle of Nizikin, and it deals with employer. There's a full chapter dealing with these relationships. So the first Mishnah talks about this simple case where there's only verbal agreement, and that verbal agreement does not allow for any specific, what was the word? Wow.
Performance.
Specific, thank you. That they use that in Canada. But it does allow for it does allow for people to in other words, this is a reputation that we want to uphold. Okay, so this is the first most simple case. When you're outside of employee-employer relationships, by the way, just so that you know, there is something called the chusar amana, which means, are you trustworthy? A person has to be trustworthy. So again, if you make a commitment, you have to follow through. If it's outside of the employee-employer relationship, we don't allow for what we call ta'aromet. We don't allow you to make a statement. However, it's still forbidden to do. You cannot walk out.
Why is there a special...
employee and employer?
Yeah.
It's a great question. I don't have a source that gives an answer for that. My feeling is that the Torah puts... I don't want to create a hierarchy of values where one doesn't necessarily exist, but if I would say it like kind of tongue-in-cheek, after marriage, employee-employer relationships is probably the most fundamental one in society. In other words, the world goes round on people's business relationships, making transference of money and work.
Employee-employee relationship is during marriage.
Yeah, we know who's the boss. Right?
If we want his opinion, ask his wife.
Does it matter for
that? Yeah.
Employee-employer.
Huh?
Is it a matter of type of employee-employer relationship?
So for this simple basic case, no, it makes no difference. The moment that, so we can talk about, I know that in business, employer and employee has a specific definition. When I'm using it in a broader term of one person is doing work for the other, and the other person is compensating them with payment or some other retribution.
How is that different than, say, if I contract with someone who's an independent contractor and they come in, they're not working for me, they're working for themselves, but they're doing work for me. Is the same rule applied?
Same thing, yes. Yep.
Well, then suppose it's, instead of an individual, it's a group of individuals, or suppose it's a company. Why wouldn't the same rule apply?
So business to business, basically, yeah.
The same rule would apply. You just, when you're dealing with a company, meaning, you're doing a merger acquisition, so you sign on with a firm, and then they assign the lawyer to your case, right? So you contracted with the firm, and then they assign the lawyer. So then it'll be a question of who's responsible, who's considered the responsible party? Who's the party to the contract? Is it the law firm overall, or is it the lawyer? So then when the lawyer doesn't perform his duties, are you going to sue in front of the Beit Din? Are you going to be suing the company or the, but it would be the same thing.
What I'm talking about is a more simple situation.
Yeah, sure.
I hire an individual to pay my ass. So then I understand that we have that moral opprobrium. Suppose I hire a group of individuals. Suppose I hire a corporation. They send whoever they want to pay my house. Is it the same?
Same thing.
It's the same thing.
Yeah, and whoever gives the word to work has to. Yeah, that's what I'm trying to say to you. That in that, I'm just trying to break that down. That relationship, what it would be is that the company's committed to you. If the company hires somebody else to do that work, so they are, right? So they have, you know, if you hire a painting company and then they send their individual, that painter is going to be what we call a baldavar in Hebrew. Baldavar means who am I talking to? Who will I be litigating
an interesting
with?
Party.
Yeah. So that will be with his employer, with the firm.
So essentially, we could generalize and say that rule applies to any service contract.
That's what I was saying. That employee and employer, although it has a specific connotation in civil law, when it comes to when in my particular language, I'm using it broadly. The Torah does define different types of workers differently, and we'll get into that hopefully in just a moment. But we'll see that it breaks down along different axes than what I believe civil law breaks down on. Okay, so that's the simple case. That's if you look in the Shulchan Aruch and Chayish and Mishpat, that comes up in Siman 333, and that's Sif Aleph. So that's the first. Once you get into Sif Bet, all of a sudden, it's an explosion. But we'll just try and touch on the some of the more basic points, and let's go from there. Okay, so Sue already signed a contract. So she signed the contract with this new company. Is she allowed to back out now?
How long is the contract for?
Is it like for it to do with
tasks? Doesn't matter. A month. Whatever the job was.
Well, if it's a month, then she has to stay for a month. Well, I'm saying like bookkeeper. That's in.
Yeah, bookkeeper.
That's indefinite.
Okay, so let's say it's indefinite.
So
it could be a year.
Forever, she's a slave of them forever?
You should know. This is a. You should know this actually came up in several. See, in halakha we have two types of svarim. We have books that deal with the law. They write down the law and they try and deal with it on a more esoteric, like on a abstract level. So that's like what I have over here, Shulchan Aruch. Just in case I forgot something, I have at least something to look back up. But then you have what we call tshuvot, and those were like the real time shelot v'tshuvot, is questions and answers. And so you can learn from those as well. They wrote them. Compile them into books. So yes, this actually came up a lot, where you had, particularly in the case of communal leadership. So traditionally, the rabbi or the cantor of the community is always under contract, but also traditionally is that it doesn't have a timeline. I don't know what they do nowadays. I think every community is different. But traditionally, like if we're going to go back to Europe, you know, where the mainstay of Jewish activity for a millennia was, there was actually, you would not put a time limit on the contract for communal leaders. So you hired a rabbi, the contract wouldn't say 1 year, 2 years. If you hired a chazan, the cantor, generally it wouldn't. You'll find exceptions. This you'll find 1 year, 2 years, that you'll find. But the rabbi and the bedin, the judges of the city, the ritual slaughter, the shochet, the guy who's what's it called? Who's, you know, slaughtering the animals, the shechita. So he will, they won't have a time limit on their contract. And that becomes incredibly complicated. What do you do in those cases? Because like, no, yeah, exactly. What, you can't get rid of, you can never fire somebody. So yeah, that's...
And they also can't quit.
Well, that's a good question. Can they quit? Yeah, can you get out of a contract? So, this is a great question. This is exactly the question that comes up once you say, so she signed the contract, is she allowed to back out? So like I told you that in according to the Torah, no, you're not allowed to just quit. You can't just quit on somebody. You signed a contract. You said you were going to provide them a service. You said you were going to provide them work. You can't just back out. We have to find a dispensation. We have to find an exception for this, which we do. And we just talked about it tangentially, and that is that the Torah says that a Jew is supposed to be subservient to God. And so that the fact that that relationship exists in the back of my mind, maybe in the front of my mind, defines the nature of my relationships with other people differently. And so that allows you to break a contract if you're the employee. You're allowed to back out. However, here's where it breaks down on the different types of employees, okay? Not all employees are equal. Not all forms of commitment to provide service or to provide labor or to be contracted as an employee in the legal sense are similar. But it breaks down along a completely different type of axis. We could go into that, you know, we could really just, we could already get into that.
Suppose the conditions of the employment change. We have a notion in secular law known as a constructive discharge. In other words, I made it so unbearable for this guy to work for me that
it's a total hypothetical.
Yeah, okay, so 100%. So the classic ways of getting out of a contract, first of all, if it's mutual, right? The same way that coming into contract is mutual, getting out of a contract is mutual. So that's, if both parties agree to break contract, then you're good. What's the problem with that? Right. The other way, obviously, of course, if someone is an actual breach of contract, then of course the contract is already, this is actually a big question. When is the contract considered terminated when you have a breach from one party? All right, is it when the other party, does the other party have to actively breach, say, okay, now the contract's terminated, or the moment there's a breach, then the contract's already terminated. So this is also a matter of debate in Jewish law. I actually hotly debated this with the rabbi who's in charge of our chabura. So we'll leave that on the back burner because that's complicated. Huh?
It's when the offshore bank account is opened up and the funds disappear.
Alrighty, so once we're already talking about signed contract, alright, you see, we only got to case 2 out of 5 and we're already stuck in the details. So here's how it breaks down in Jewish law, and this is incredible. I want to see how you guys feel about this, okay? So we have two categories of employees, two categories of workers, and one category of employer. We don't break down along the lines of what type of employer you are. A person who wants somebody else to work for them is the same all over, and that conceptually I think is very easy to realize. But what about the type of worker that I am? So Here's how it works. There's two words that you have to know, really important words in Hebrew. I'm just going to use the Hebrew for a second. The first word is a kablan, and the second word is sachil. So in modern Hebrew, these terms are used as well. The question is, what do they mean legally? What do they mean halachically? In Hebrew, in modern Hebrew, if you say kablan, usually it's a builder, right? Somebody who's construction, generally, almost 100%. Okay, so but the word kablan in halacha is as a particular type of laborer. Now, how does it break down? The truth is, it's a little bit complicated. Everything's complicated. But let me just say what seems to be the most simple language, and you'll see how it immediately becomes not so obvious. The most simple language is like this, is that a person who's not a kablan, so then they are a sakhir. Sakhir comes from the word schar, which means wages. That's where the word comes from. So in Hebrew, if you turn it into sakhir, it becomes the noun. It becomes a different type of noun than the word schar. Schar is the wage, and the schir is the person earning the wage. Okay? So the same word. When do they become a sakhir? So they become a sakhir when they are working on a timed basis. Okay? Their wages are connected to time worked, to hours. Oh, I don't want to say hours because I don't want to put myself in that box. But when you're getting paid for your time, you're considered a sakhir. When you're getting paid for the job, then you're considered a kablan. That's, if you will just read the most basic source, the Ramah, that's the words that you will get. That if you're a timed worker, if you are paid based on your time, so then that's considered a sakhir. The simplest case would be a music teacher. So I teach guitar. If anybody wants music lessons or has kids, I'm a teacher, okay? I also play. So a music teacher, generally, now you can hire, there are, when you get to the very professional level, you can say, I want to learn a particular skill until you teach me that skill. But generally, you pay them by the hour, almost always, even on the professional level. You're paying by the hour. So that's a typical sakhir. That's obvious. It's clear they're getting paid by the hour, and that's very simple. Now, when you talk about, so anybody outside of that, it's like, meaning the prototypical case of a kablan would be, I hire a tailor to make me a custom-made suit. So he gives me a price on the suit, and that's what I pay for. That's a typical case of kablan. It's like the prototypical case that you'll find in the Shulchan Aruch. But then you have people in between. And that's where it gets complicated. So, for example, let's say I hire somebody. I'm just pulling out a case that actually is written about. So that's why it sounds a little bit random. But let's say I hire, you know, actually I'm going to the Pacific Northwest in the summer, God willing. And, you know, when you go around there, whenever you want to go to Olympic Park or whatever, most of the time you're going to use a ferry. You're going to be getting your putting your car on a ferry to get across, you know, all the peninsulas and whatever. So you hire a ferry. Now, the ferry is a fee, flat fee. Right? Yeah, you could imagine you could broaden this to any case that you possibly want. Get on a bus, whatever it is. Okay, so the ferry has a flat fee, and it has you know how much time it's going to take, and you say, you know, you're promising you're going to get me there in 4.5 hours, barring extreme circumstances. So good. So I'm paying a fee to get my car across the lake. Now here's the thing. You'll say, well, of course this is a kablan because I'm not paying for 4.5 hours. I'm paying for the ride. But you can argue and say, well, when do you have to provide that service? I have to provide it in a particular time frame. So when I have to provide the service in a particular time frame, does that mean that now I'm being paid for that specific time? Okay, now it doesn't seem like this should be true, but when you actually expand the concept of sakhir versus kablan and try and think of it more deeply, why should there be a difference of an hourly worker versus a non-hourly worker? You see that you actually do have to contend with this type of argument. Why? What should be the difference between somebody who is paid by the hour versus somebody who is paid by the job? And I pose that to the table. What do you guys think? What's like the most fundamental difference?
One who's getting paid by the hour is going to work as long as possible, and the one who's being paid by the job is either going to walk off, which unfortunately happens, or get the job done as quickly as possible.
Okay. What if we're looking at it from the perspective of okay. Well, we can talk about it like this, but let's say we're talking about it from the perspective of the employer.
More simple people will probably go by the hour, and more sophisticated will go by the job.
We'll go by the job, yeah, definitely. So you'll have a breakdown in people, and I'll tell you why that is.
That seems like a dig at lawyers, by the way.
Lawyers who need to have certain amount of hours.
Not transactional.
Well, here's how we could define these things, and then maybe that could actually explain that phenomenon. It's like this, is that when you're working by the hour, so then you need to... you have to do the work when somebody else is demanding the work. When you're working by the job, you don't have to do it when you can do it whenever you want. So let's say I'm a tailor. So somebody hired me to make a suit for them. I can make the suit whenever I want. If I could do it in 2 hours, I'll do it in 2 hours. If it takes me 5 hours, it takes me 5 hours. If I want to do it Saturday night, if I want to do it Thursday morning, I get to do it whenever I want. So like the job that I do is there's a lot of things like that, you know. So like I do Jewish outreach and building Jewish identity and community. So a lot of what I do is you know, creating events and facilitating events and facilitating shirim. I said David, that's where I know David from. He comes to Sunday morning a little bagel club that we have. So I could do these things whenever I want. So I don't get paid by the hour. It's like I have to, you know, my job, let's say the contract will say I have to have a certain amount of interactions or a certain amount of events but I can do the events whenever I want. I can, if I want to make an interaction with somebody at 2 a.m., I can do that too. So it's on me. So that grants a lot more freedom. So if we're going to define it that way, and we're going to say that there should be a difference between somebody who's an hourly worker because of the amount of freedom that the job provides, the amount of flexibility, so then even if somebody's getting paid for the job, but if they are bound by a specific time frame, maybe that itself removes that sense of freedom that the kablan, the person who has to do the job as opposed to work by the hour, has. Because the whole advantage of a kablan would be that he has that freedom to move. Now, why should we break down employment and labor based off of these qualities? This sounds extremely out of left field.
It's we do the same thing.
Do we? Let's see.
In secular law, we have a distinction, for instance, between independent contractors who have the freedom, they can come and go whenever they want, and employees where the employer exerts a high degree of control over the employee. And in fact, courts have a very complicated set of factors, in some cases as much as almost 20 different factors that courts consider to determine whether someone is an independent contractor or an employee, and it has an important bearing on taxes, because
yeah.
because if you have to withhold taxes.
Yeah, that's right.
If they're an independent contractor, the burden to file the taxes is on the contractor. Also, there's a distinction similarly between managerial employees who are not paid by the hour, but they're paid by because of their responsibility, and workers who, if they work more than say 40 hours a week, they're entitled to time and a half for their overtime. So we have similar types of
There could be parallel to that. I learned about the differences between always in the context of taxes. That was where my studies took me.
Maybe the Torah value the time and expectation between the parties?
Very much so. Yeah, that's definitely along the lines. 100%. The Torah is valuing the 100%, trying to figure out what's the relationship between the employee and employer. And in order to define that relationship, what we do is we look at how much exact. Well, Mr.
Sock.
Thank you. Oh.
Will you call me God?
Just don't call him polite.
So lost my train of thought on that. But it will break down. Gosh.
Time and expectation.
Yeah, thank you. So we're trying to define the relationship, and the relationship will be the amount of control. That's what it was. The amount of control that an employee will be able to assert over an employee. Now, why should that be? And this gets back to that concept that we were talking about. The nature of the laborer versus worker, laborer, worker, and employee, that the nature of that relationship is always seen in the context of that I have this, like my ultimate service is to God, to the Torah, okay? So that means that when I try and figure out what type of relationship I have with my employer, it will be about how much control am I giving to another human being over me? Isn't that incredible? That's how we see work. That's how we see at least the relationships that we form in the workspace, is in terms of how much control am I allowing another person to assert over me in order for a particular payoff. There's always a payoff, right? I'm giving over my own self-authority to somebody else in order that I can make money, let's say. So we see it specifically in those terms, and that's where it breaks down. So then when somebody is an hourly worker, let's say, a typical, prototypical hourly worker, they have to work the entire hour to the extent that in the days of the Mishnah, if you were an hourly worker, you would say an abridged version of Kriyat Shema. You would not say all three paragraphs. You would say an abridged version of the prayers. You're not allowed to say the full prayers. You have to say an abridged version. You're not allowed to say the whole Birkat HaMazon, right? So there was a very high demand and moral demand from an hourly worker that you need to work. The person's paying you. It doesn't just break down by the hour. It prorates by the second. So every second you have to be accountable. Otherwise, you can be seen as if you're stealing from the employer. So okay, nowadays the work culture is maybe a little bit different. But
so that's why they refer to the Kitzer Shulchan
Aruch. Maybe. So maybe we'll have a different meaning when we contract to be a hire an hourly worker. We recognize that maybe out of an hour you're going to be productive. We're like, what do we add these days? 7 minutes?
Wouldn't it be the other way around though? The salary worker is being paid no matter what time he takes, so he needs to get out and do his work. The other one, if he works less because he prays longer, he gets paid less. So he's not stealing.
Yeah, that's exactly the point. The other one, the person.
The hourly worker is not stealing. The salary worker could be stealing.
Oh, if he, okay. I mean, obviously, if he ended up praying for longer, and then he goes back to his boss and says, hey, I took 20 minutes out to pray. And the boss is like, you know, it's fine, I'll pay you anything.
He's clocked in.
And, you know, like, nobody steals away. He's out in the orchard. He's up in a tree. It's like, that's it. Are you allowed to, literally to the detail, are you allowed to come down from the tree in order to say the one parts of Kriyat Shema that you're allowed? That you have to stay up in the tree. It's wasting time, etc. Amazing, amazing distinction. Okay, so that's why we break down along these lines. Now, Sue already signed the contract, so she's going to be a bookkeeper. She's a bookkeeper, so usually our contracts, let's say, are for a year. Let's say it was for a year, right? Usually we do a certain timeline. And then it's also like, okay, so you have to be a bookkeeper between the hours of... But then we do a yearly salary. In Israel, it's a monthly salary. The salary is always talked about by the month, but over in America, it's always by the year. I don't know why there's a difference like this, but that's what it is. So over here, it's by the year. So somebody like a bookkeeper, you know, well, it's not going to be so easy to determine what type of worker they are. Now, what's the difference? What's actually the difference? So here's where we really get into the complication, you know, and we're already just rounding how long? 40 minutes. So the first thing you have to recognize is that whenever we're talking about backing out of a contract, so then there's going to be two sides of the equation. The employer backing out, meaning the employer trying to fire the employee. So that's going to have its own set of laws. And then there's the employee trying to back out of the contract for some sort of personal gain. And that's going to have its sort of laws. In the Torah, the employer and employee are seen as mutually exclusive things. We cannot make assumptions that because there is a particular remedy for an employer when the employee backs out of a contract, that will be true the other way around. So we have to deal with them as mutually exclusive things. Again, one of the reasons why it's impossible to touch on all the details today. But so what would be the difference if she is if we look at her as hourly and we're going to prorate the yearly salary, if we're going to say no, there's a particular job that has to get done. We could look at it as providing a statement, as taking care of the books. Probably in this case, it will lean towards the hourly, but we'd have to know the details of the case if it were real.
To the remedy that you have.
The remedies.
Maybe a breach of contract. In one case, would be you owe me X number of dollars for the hours you should have paid me for. In the other case, you didn't make the suit, so I want either the suit or the value of the suit.
Yeah. So the remedies is. So let's see how the remedies play out. Let's try and get into it as much as we can. So let's say. Okay. So let's talk about where they signed a contract. Now, signing a contract itself is not obvious that should be considered anything different than a verbal agreement. In other words, this itself needs to be figured out. At the end of the day, the Noda Behuda is a prominent posek in Prague. You go visit his gravesite today. Actually, when you're looking out over Prague, you know exactly where he's buried because there's a huge radio pillar. I don't know what they call it. Like a big
tower?
Yeah, radio tower, antenna, right next to his grave. So you know exactly where he's buried. So a tour guide pointed that out to me. So he was a prominent figure in Prague in the 1700s, and he writes clearly that if you sign a contract, this is considered coming into contract, you're not allowed to back out anymore. You're not allowed to back out. So it's not like what we said before where there's just a verbal agreement where everybody could back out and maybe there's, you know, moral implications. Over here, no, now there's legitimate financial implications. So they started a contract. In theory, she should not be able to back out, but we have this dispensation from the Torah, which is you have to be an Eved. You have to be a worker of God. You're working for God. You're not working for somebody else. What that means is that there is there's probably a word for it, but there's an unspoken clause, like something you don't even need to put in the contract because it's already written into contracts, that a hourly worker is allowed to back out on the job whenever they want. Allowed to back out whenever they want. If they put in a clause in the contract, or if they made some sort of other kinyan, the holy pen, to try and override this exception, there is a hot debate. There's a hot debate. Some say you could, some say you cannot. Whether this hourly worker could back out. Because again, the Torah says there's a theological reason why you have to be able to back out of this contract as an hourly worker. It's a theological reason, and that is that I'm working for God. But what if I try and override that? So this is not obvious. Generally, from what the head rabbi has told us, generally the practice is that we side with the opinion that you can't override this. That you cannot override this. So this is the moment that they're hourly, you can back out of it. Now, he said an interesting case. This is incredible. So there was a firm in Lakewood, and I don't know what they were doing, but they were hiring Neither does anybody. But they had some sort. They were training girls. Whatever work that they were doing, it was very. They were training girls. There was about a 2-year training period, and then they would, you know, take them on as full employers into the company. Now, they were doing. I think it was a service of some sort to try and help girls post high school and then post the gap year, kind of get into the labor force. This is what I understood. What happened was is that they would, huh? Which labor force is that? I don't know. You gotta go to Lakewood.
It's
the labor
force.
Oh.
You got it.
So,
literally labor. That's
right. I'm on record over here. So, what happened was, it didn't quite work out the way that they wanted to, because instead of joining the company that they had trained them to join, is they would do the training, and then they would move to another company, or they would get married and move away, right? So it wasn't quite working out the way that they wanted it to. So in order to facilitate this, the person said, okay, here's what we're going to do. We're going to put a clause in your contract that basically fines you like an insane amount of money that makes it completely not worth your while, right? So it's like if you back out of this contract after, you know, before 2 years, you're going to basically pay back all the money that you made, something like that, right? So here's a funny thing. They're not stipulating against, they're not trying to say that you can't back out. You can absolutely back out. That, like the Torah says, you know, you're an hourly worker, you're allowed to back out of this contract no matter what. Totally, back out. You're good. You have that freedom. But you agreed that if you access that freedom, if you, what?
Exercise,
thank you. If you exercise that freedom, then you will have to pay me a lot of money. It's like, well, how do we look at that? Is that just same idea, different language, or is it like, no, this is actually a loophole? This is.
Well, they're getting an extra benefit. They're getting the training, so even after they quit or back out, they still have that knowledge that they got at your expense or the employer's expense. So I think it's a different situation.
I like that. Actually, that makes that rings true to me.
But it depends.
Yeah, that actually rings very true. That they're being fined.
These enormous penalties that are interpreted as being unenforceable.
Right. No, I think this was like practical. This would be like return all the money, but you know, not like nothing crazy. Okay. Yeah. It wasn't like.
It's crazy.
This was considered practical, but it was something that you could pay back, but you're clearly not going to. Right. So if you have any intentions of leaving this company before 2 years, you're just not going to start. Yeah, but I actually agree that there's still a benefit of the training, right? You still got something out of it. I agree with that. And so the truth is that most, apparently on this case, most of the Dayanim who were involved ruled that this was okay. This was a tenable.
The penalty.
Yeah, the penalty was fine. You're allowed to keep that in the contract, and they would have to pay it. And this was not considered going against what the Torah's expectations of the worker are, right? So that's a fascinating loophole.
How often was that enforced?
Oh, that, I don't know. That they don't tell.
I mean, of course.
Yeah, I doubt it. Okay, so that's the first thing. Then now the next thing would be, so if we turn that onto a kablan, if we turn that onto a person who has a job and they're paid for the job, not the hourly, so they have a little bit more freedom. So here's an interesting nuance. Here's an interesting thing. This seems to be a debate. Now again, the Note of Yehuda contends like this, that as far as whether I'm allowed to back out of the contract, it doesn't matter what type of employee I am. So even though we could say there's a difference between how much authority I gave over to my boss, whether I'm an hourly worker or not, that injunction of the Torah to say, the person, an employee, can always back out of the contract remains true across the board. They can always back out. There will still be differences in the way that they will earn the compensation for the work that was already done. There will still be differences. But as far as the right to back out is the same. This is what the Note of Yehuda contended. Very authoritative opinion. Now, if we were to say this, you're allowed to back out. So then, however it is that we're going to figure out how much money you're owed for the work done, let's say they're you did, you know, for sure in an hourly worker, it would be easier to figure out. Maybe in the case where there's a half job, it would be a little much more complicated usually, because a lot of times you can't get that job finished, right? Half a suit, can't bring it to the tailor. He's going to say, don't give me half a suit.
Is it so simple that you would even be required to quantify the amount done? If you paid for the
It is that simple. Yes, you absolutely have to quantify the amount done and figure out how much it's worth and then pay them for that. The question is like this: if I'm allowed to back out, if I have this dispensation that says I'm allowed out of this contract, I could ask for my wages immediately. If I'm not allowed to back out of the contract, if I'm not allowed to back out and then I break the contract, then the owner or the employer could say, I'm not paying you until the job gets done. Because the way that, this is another aspect of Jewish law, also a topic in and of itself, when you hire somebody and you're expected to pay them earnings for their work, when does that earnings become due? Is it due at the beginning? Is it due as the job is fulfilled at the end? This is a very complicated thing. I know that for sure when it comes to real estate, there's a whole body of law talking about
if, as, and when.
Yeah, but when the contractors have to, when they could be paid, depending on when the work is done, etc. But in a
small, walk off the job.
Absolutely, yeah. So that's a big thing. But in a smaller job, for sure, we would still have this. Like, when are you actually due for payment? When does the owner have to pay you? So it could be you could write a contract that will override this, but in and of itself, if it's not stipulated in the contract, and you can imagine contracts that don't have this type of clause, it's actually at the end of the work. It's at the end of the work. So an hourly worker will differ very significantly from somebody who's hired for a job, and that an hourly worker is, if I finish the hour, I get paid for that because I did work for you for that hour. If I hired you to do a job, then it's like until the job is done, I don't owe you any money. And so if you back out in the middle of the job, if you had the right to back out, so then that constitutes the end of the job. In other words, the job is... I'm
bogus notary. Brought them to file a complaint against the police. Oh, that's a civil matter. Really? Trespass, forgery, a civil matter. So we ended up suing, getting them. But they said, how quickly should we file suit? Because they knew people in this house and they're doing renovations. They said, wait till the renovations are done.
So you got
that's
the
practical advice. About the house package,
yep. Sometimes a little patience. That's right. Oh my gosh. All right, so what? Just to end off again, because we're just getting to the basics here, but at least to hear that there should be some difference between a sakhir versus a kablan always, and again, you know, assuming that we can even define in a particular case who these people are, is so. Let's say we go. Let's just side with the Noda Behuda for a moment, just for argument's sake. So that is that they're both allowed to back out, okay? So there will still be a difference. If they came into contract, let's say they started the work even, there will still be a difference if they back out. And that is like this. It's a little bit nuanced, but just to speak it out, because there is a difference. The sakhir is awarded the market benefit. If he backs out and there's a market benefit to him, he's awarded that. And if there's a market disadvantage, he's shielded from that. And it's the inverse for the kablan. The kablan is given he's not shielded from market disadvantage, and he's not given the benefit of a market advantage. Let me bring that up with an example. Very simple example. Somebody gets hired to do a job, any job. Let's take the hourly person for a moment. So he's hired to work for 8 hours, and he works for four. And each hour he's supposed to earn $1. Okay? So he quits after 4 hours. So he's earned $4. Yeah? Now, let's say labor during those 4 hours, because you know, at the end of the day, labor is a little bit more expensive than the beginning of the day, let's just say. So labor has gone up, and for me to be able to finish the day, to finish the day's work, I could, you know, get a guy from Home Depot to finish the work, but it's gonna cost more. Okay? So the hourly worker doesn't have to absorb that extra cost at all, and he walks home with the $4, the work that he did, and he's good to go. If the person was hired to do a job and he walked off halfway through the job, so the job was cost $8, he did half the job, now he's up to four. But then in order to finish the job, it's gonna cost me a lot more money. And this is very usual. So the amount, the cost increase will be deducted from his wages, but not more than what he actually is owed. So you're not going to be able to take money out of pocket for this. Why you can't take money out of pocket is a whole separate discussion. You won't be able to take money out of pocket, but it will be deducted from his wages. So he,
you give him nothing?
He's
you
not.
You just can't take money from him.
Yeah, yeah, but you don't. You could give him nothing. Yeah. Now again, this is assuming that he's even owed money in the first place. In other words, if we go with the opinion that a kablan who backs out doesn't get money, then he's going to have a hard time. Assuming he's even owed money, he has to absorb any cost increases in labor. And the same will work the other way, is that if market, okay, this, you know, that's a, this is even, a, there is an opinion that if the market goes up, so then the hired worker, when he backs out halfway through the job, he's going to actually make money. Now, this is a little bit controversial. Not everybody agrees to this, but let's say labor costs go down, right? So it's gonna cost the owner of the company less money for the remaining 4 hours of the day. So there are some opinions that actually take the gain that the owner stands to gain, and they will require him to pay it to the worker. That's other opinions say, wow, that's absurd. You walked out halfway through the job, now you should make more money. Okay, so this is a big argument. How to rationalize the first one is, again, can, you know, be its own 20-minute conversation. What we didn't touch on, just, okay, so that's I think we're gonna end it with that. But what we didn't touch on, just to give you a taste, I mean, what we didn't touch on is damages. Let's say there's actual damages, right? So if I get hired for a job, and by me walking off the job, there's gonna be significant damages. What if I was about to be hired, you promised to hire me, and so I turned down two other amazing offers that were available at the time, I turned them down, and then you decide that you're not gonna sign a contract with me in the end, now you caused me significant loss. What if I was gonna come into contract with you, and then I backed out, and now you can't find anybody else, and the whole business venture collapses, right? So when there's loss involved, that's a whole separate, really a whole separate package. It's extremely complicated, but again, this is just some of the things that we didn't talk about. Another thing that we didn't talk about, which is also fascinating, is that when it comes to work, so we talked about how you need to engage in a kinyan. Yeah, and for a contract to commence financially, there has to be a kinyan. One of the kinyanim that we have over here is beginning work. When you begin work, we see that as the beginning of the contract. So even if Sue, let's say, hadn't signed the contract, but she had actually begun working for the company, then the whole the second half of our discussion is still applicable because she actually began work.
That's the course of action.
Huh?
That's the course of action.
That was always the course of action. That's where that comes up. So that's also a discussion. And then, of course, there's a myriad of other details, but this is just at least the beginning of it. All righty.